From Toronto, Canada, home of igloos, polar bears, and flying hockey pucks, this is Inside Movies and TV.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
Hello there, everybody, and welcome back. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Inside Movies and TV for the second weekend in September. My name is Aaron Shaw. With me is Jamie Hosking.
Hey, now.
And Dennis, I'm not saying your last name. Dennis is joining us again. And he's going to be prime in this episode of Inside Movies and TV, as he's been following and going through the TIFF motions, as we're neck deep now, well, maybe in my case knee deep, in the Toronto International Film Festival, which of course launched just this past Thursday. So Dennis has been going to movies and writing reviews, and he's got stuff that he's going to tell us in very shortly. But maybe you can give us a quick one sentence or some so synopsis. How's your experience been this year?
It's a really well-organized movie festival so far. There's really no breakout film like there was last year with Slumdog Millionaire that was a sleeper. That was going direct to video and then all of a sudden caught the audience's fancy. But there's nothing like that. The one movie that's really got a lot of buzz is the Jason Reitman movie Up in the Air with George Clooney, which I'm seeing later this week. I wonder, because, you know, Ivan Reitman is the fellow who gave the property and a lot of donation money to the Bell Lightbox, future home of the festival. So the Reitman family is in the festival's good books, and just so happens Jason Reitman's film is getting a lot of buzz. So
that's good.
Until you see the film, it makes you wonder.
And with 10 Academy Award Best Picture nominations this year, you never know what is in store, what can pop up.
That's right.
Things that you don't expect to be successful could be successful.
Right. Well, there was one development at the film festival that surprised a lot of people. The much ballyhooed public appearance by Neil Young is not going to happen. It's at the AMC Young Dundas Square. He was going to be there to help introduce Jonathan Demme's second concert film about him, called The Neil Young Trunk Show. Of course, you remember the fabulous 2006 Heart of Gold. That was just a great concert film. But he's officially canceled his plans. And in fact, one report in the Toronto Star said that Neil Young said he never even knew he was supposed to be there. So who knows what the truth is. But no reason has been given. Nobody knows what really happened. But there are rumors a notable performer would take his place alongside Jonathan Demme, of course, at Silence of the Lambs, at the Young and Dundas Square Spectacle later in the run of the festival. I'm betting it's going to be André-Philippe Gagnon who's going to do an impression of Neil Young. What do you guys think?
I don't know. I don't even know who that is. It was always off store shelves when it came out on DVD.
My guess is that it's probably going to be Eddie Vedder. I don't know. Eddie Vedder, the lead singer from Pearl Jam, who's a gigantic fan of Neil Young. In fact, he's included a lot of Neil Young in his career. There's a whole stretch of Pearl Jam's recording career where they teamed up with Neil Young for at least one or two albums, including Neil Young's one of Neil Young's albums. And Eddie Vedder's kind of solo career sounds a lot like Neil Young. But I don't know. Who can you get to replace a living legend like that? I'm not sure exactly. Maybe they're scrambling to try and get him. Dennis, did you also have other insights into the movies that you saw this week? Maybe you can fill us in on some of the pictures you've seen so far.
Right. Well, thank you, Jamie. Well, the attention Thursday night was all at Roy Thomson Hall with the gala presentation of Creation. I went to see a movie that's been also getting a lot of buzz, especially after Sundance Film Festival, where it won two awards, and that's the movie called An Education, which is a very charming, wonderful, romantic comedy, bittersweet drama, which is the story of a 17-year-old girl named Jenny who's growing up in the London suburb of Twickenham in about 1961 England. And what's interesting about the story is it's post-war Britain, so everything's pretty conservative. These are people who still remember food rationing and the war and the Battle of Britain. But also, it's the dawn of the swinging 60s, you know, and just around the corner is, of course, Carnaby Street, the Beatles, the British invasion. Now, one day, Jenny, who's a very serious student, she plays the cello, loves all things French, meets a fellow who's twice her age, a guy named David. He's very suave, debonair, charming. He's played by Peter Sarsgaard. And anyway, they start dating, and he sweeps her off her feet. And as Nick Hornby, the screenplay writer, who, of course, you remember did the screenplay for High Fidelity, he really represents that swinging 60s. He starts taking her out to jazz clubs, art auctions, fancy meals, and he has two friends that they hang with, and played by one of them is Rosamund Pike, who's kind of a dim-witted, gorgeous woman, blonde, but they're all part of the new era. And as the romance comes along, of course, Jenny, by the way, wants to go to Oxford, which is very crucial to the plot. David wants to take her actually to Oxford for a weekend, and he claims to have been a student of C.S. Lewis, the author, of course, the Lion, the Wardrobe, the Witch, something like that. The Chronicles of Narnia.
Chronicles of Narnia, yes.
Of course. Anyway, so he absolutely charms her very conservative father, of course, who wants the best for his daughter and doesn't want her to go. They go. Of course, he attempts to seduce her, and she wants to save herself for at least her 17th birthday, which happens. Of course, David decides to proposes to take her to Paris, and she plans to lose her virginity in Paris. And then something happens, and of course, a hint here, it's Peter Sarsgaard, who, how often has he played a nice guy in his films, eh? Mm-hmm. So something happens, and she gets a hint in Oxford, there's some shady business dealings going on. Anyway, her school mistress, her teacher, are worried about her. Her grades are plummeting. They're worrying about her future in Oxford. She would like nothing more than to marry this guy and be a housewife, of course, to everybody's shock. Anyway, the rest of the film is what happens, this twist, and the sort of growing of age. This is a coming-of-age film, and the growing of age of adult awareness and kind of a tinge of bittersweet cynicism, as Blake would say, the age of innocence versus experience. But anyway, this is a film. It's opening widely Thanksgiving weekend. It's a film that it's great for the entire family, teens and up, of course. Children wouldn't be interested. And I recommend that one. The other film, of course, is Creation, the opening gala film. And that I was surprised it was the gala film because it really is the first non-Canadian film to open the festival since 1976, so you would think it would be something very special. And it's okay. It's kind of average, but it's the story of Charles Darwin, and this is the 200th anniversary of his birth and the 150th anniversary of his publication of and writing of The Origin of the Species, which in the film is called the biggest original idea in the history of thought is what the film says. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when you usually think of Charles Darwin, he's a guy sort of carved in stone, this kind of intellectual and everything. What the movie shows him to be is a very warm human family man, and it's more a story about grief and the grief that he experiences following the death of his a child named Annie, who dies at the age of 10 from infantile tuberculosis. And there's a real struggle between Darwin, of course, who is really challenging the existence of a God with The Origin of Species, and his wife, especially, who's very religious and thinks that her husband's going to be facing eternal damnation. And the struggle between this kind of empirical kind of analysis of where we all came from and the interconnectedness of the species versus, following the biblical story of descent from Adam and on. And as one critic said very brightly and very succinctly, he says that men are, rather than fallen angels, are risen apes. So anyway, the story follows this. Paul Bettany plays a great arc as as Darwin, and Jennifer Connelly is wonderful as the wife. And they're married in real life, so their arguments have a real tinge of authenticity to them. They know where to push each other's buttons. But again, I don't think this movie. First of all, it doesn't have a deal yet, a distribution deal in the States. It does in Canada, but it makes you wonder what kind of a box office life this type of film is going to have. It's there's really not a lot of action, not a lot happens. By the way, it's based on a book called Annie's Box, which was written by the great-great-grandson of Darwin, a fellow, I think his name is Randall Keynes, and it just so happens that he's not only is he related a descendant of Darwin, but he's also of John Maynard Keynes, the economist. So this guy's genes are just loaded. So anyway, keep an eye out for it. Date hasn't been released in Canada, but it's a beautifully shot film by the director John Amiel, who people probably remember from the singing detective episodes of, I think he directed six, the singing detective series.
All right.
And I would recommend it, but it's not going to be a film that's going to shake the rafters. And I think Bettany maybe might get some attention at the Oscars. I don't know. But it's a really masterful performance. But I sort of walked away from it sort of with a shrug. It didn't do anything for me like an education did.
Well, you know, it follows Charles Darwin, and Darwin himself is controversial enough, so it's going to hit different strings with different people. So, to get an opinion of it, I guess you'd have to see it yourself. Paul Bettany is one of my favorite actors. I shouldn't say of all time, just one of my favorite current actors. I like a lot of the work that he's done, and I was just trying to think, you were going on and you're reviewing about it, saying there's not a lot of action, so you don't know how well it's going to do at the box office or if it's going to gather much attention. I just have two movies to say to you. There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. They were two of the most boring movies ever. I enjoyed There Will Be Blood a lot more because of Daniel Day-Lewis's movie, but I couldn't stand No Country for Old Men. And, of course, we all know that went on to win the Best Picture Oscar 2 years ago. And the purposes of TIFF is to get distribution sales, is to sell your movie into the U.S. And the fact that Canada already has at least distribution rights before the States is kind of a compliment to ourselves.
I think so. But, Aaron, you got to take into mind, you know, the American South, you know, and where Darwin is still the point of high contention, you know, the Baptist Belt. And I think that that might have a factor. The irony is that the film is called Creation, it's about an evolutionist. And the creationists are his opponents. Yet it's called Creation because of the element of his own creation of this theory, and also the fact that there's actually a scene where he's seen praying to a god that he's conflicted about to try and save his daughter from dying, that if you do exist, will you save her? And which is a very moving scene and a great moment for Paul Bettany. But this part, you know, the daughter keeps showing up and he keeps talking to the daughter and he's as if he's haunted. So I would say rather than about evolution, the movie is more about grief, a parent's grief, which is not what you would expect.
Well, on the Paul Bettany front, Dennis, I just wanted to – have you heard any early buzz about Young Victoria? Because I know that's closing TIFF and that also stars Paul Bettany, co-stars Paul Bettany.
Boy, he should be the poster boy for
this
the festival.
Is what
I didn't know that.
He's opening and closing the
I haven't
the
heard anything
festival.
About that film, but once again, it's I understand it's about the romance between Queen Victoria and her consort, Prince Albert, right?
Who I believe is played by Bettany.
There you go.
So I was just wondering. Cause
it's still early in the festival, too.
Yeah, it ends in still a week to go in
the But there's
film
nothing
festival.
Really that's really got the sort of this is the one that's going to be the Oscar. Not that anybody felt that about Slumdog Millionaire, but
right.
There was an enthusiasm surrounding Slumdog Millionaire. You got to see this
at
the festival.
Yeah.
It won the People's Choice Award.
We'll see what wins People's Choice Award, and we'll just say that's going to win the Best Picture.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dennis. We really appreciate the insight. I know that both Aaron and I are hoping to catch at least one or two screenings over the course of this week. We're not sure if we actually will. I know Aaron's been in contact with Miramax, or they contacted him regarding a screening, and hopefully he'll get it to see one of the movies that Miramax is putting on. And I know, Dennis, your wife is in a short film that's in a presentation on Monday night. Would love to see that as well.
That's her dream. That's in a film festival film.
That's amazing,
she
I think.
An unspeaking part.
Yeah. One other thing I want to talk about really quickly about the film festival before we wrap up and move on to the regular news. And that is a police investigation going on in relation to the festival. Police are searching for a thief who made off with a briefcase containing an Italian filmmaker's script in the equivalent of $12,000 in cash. The producer was at the Four Seasons Hotel at Avenue Road in Yorkville Avenue in Toronto, which is very popular with film festival stars and movie folk alike. A lot of people go around that area to see if they can catch some stargazing, see if they can see some celebrities in the nearby Starbucks, that sort of thing. This is where the theft occurred. Apparently, the filmmaker placed his briefcase on a sofa in the hotel lobby on Thursday, and a man who was captured by security cameras entered the lobby, sat down beside the briefcase, and placed his knapsack beside it. He then picked up both items and walked out. The producer, who was in Toronto, of course, for the film festival, told police he planned to shoot his own film while here. The cash, about 7,000 to 8,000 euros, was to finance the venture. Investigators were not to identify the victim, and police are searching for a white male, 35 to 40 years old, 6 feet tall, weighing 200 pounds. Anyone with information is asked to call police at area code 416-808-5300. Anyway, let's move on to some regular news. Dennis, you've got, or sorry, Aaron, you've got a fantastic story for us. I know you're looking forward to talking about.
This is my favorite story of the week has come out. And this week, we've got a couple of Disney stories coming up in just the next couple of minutes. This is the most chief amongst them, as Disney made a bunch of announcements this past week at the D23 Expo in Anaheim, California, where Disney Films president Dick Cook concluded a presentation on the company's future cinematic slates by bringing down the house. This is the big news. For the big announcement, I'll set up the scene for you, is the curtains parted and the mast of a pirate ship emerged from the misty darkness. Silhouetted behind the sail was the outline of Johnny Depp in person, dressed in full Jack Sparrow attire, drunkenly swaying at the screen above him, which faded out, and the Pirates of the Caribbean logo appeared, revealing for the first time the title of the upcoming fourth film in the film franchise, which will be called Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. And beneath that were the words Summer 2011. So it's officially official. The fourth Pirates movie is 2 years away, and I am very excited about it. As anybody who knows me, reads the blog, or listens to us on the podcast is well aware, I am a huge fan of this franchise, which was the favorite franchise of the decade on my poll. Now for some of the news bits. There is no indication from either Johnny Depp or Cook about the story of the film, but needless to say, the crowd leapt to their feet in a frenzied excitement. It should be noted that there is a 1988 pirate-themed fantasy novel out there that's of the same name, called On Stranger Tides by Tim Powers. So, of course, speculation was rampant that this is the source material for the movie. So here's the synopsis of the book. Puppeteer John Chandagnac, who was sailing to Jamaica to get revenge on the uncle who had stolen his father's inheritance, has no choice but to join the buccaneers who have taken him prisoner, and soon becomes known as the pirate Jack Shandy. He finds himself learning to survive in a treacherous new world of cutlass fights, sea battles, and voodoo magic on the sun-blinded tropical islands. And the legendary Blackbeard is in the story, and he's assembling a ruthless navy of pirates, both living and undead, to voyage to find the fabled Fountain of Youth. And Jack Shandy must use magic, swordsmanship, and even his puppeteer skills to free himself and the girl he has fallen in love with from Blackbeard's deadly supernatural domination. Now, you'll recall that the last Pirates of the Caribbean film, At World's End, ended with Jack Sparrow keeping a portion of a map that shows the way to the Fountain of the Youth, which Barbossa was also after when he hijacked the Black Pearl off of Tortuga. So there's speculation that both Jack Sparrow and Barbossa are going to once again team up, only this time they're going to fight Blackbeard.
Very good. That's exciting news, actually. Now, they've got some work to do. 2 years is not long for a film of this magnitude, not to quote Admiral Ackbar from Return of the Jedi, but 2 years. You know, less than 2 years. Well, this is summer. This is fall 2009 we're going
it
into.
It is, yeah. Well,
Johnny, no director.
No director officially.
No screenplay that we know of.
No screenplay, but if they have the source material, I know it's strong indications that the book is what's going to inspire it, then it shouldn't be too bad to do. Yeah, it would get fast-tracked. Disney's already said they wanted to fast-track a Pirates movie. Johnny Depp's schedule, in fact, is clear after... He's just wrapped up filming Alice in Wonderland, which comes out next,
of course.
Which comes out in March. But beyond that, he was attached to a lot of projects, such as Lone Ranger, and
all right, we've talked about Lone Ranger before.
A few other projects which have kind of gone on the back burner, or stuff is just not gone according to plan. So Johnny Depp is already signed on to do a fourth one a long time ago to play Jack Sparrow. He loves the character, as you can tell. I mean, for him to show up at a press conference in Jack Sparrow attire, putting on the role, must have been a sight. So, yeah, there is a lot of work to do. They are going to do a scaled-down budget. So all that's known is that Johnny Depp was going to return. If indeed they're going to tie into the end of At World's End, they'll probably get Jeffrey Rush to come back as Barbossa. But it also means, there won't be Will Turner, there won't be Orlando Bloom or Keira Knightley or Jack Davenport.
Do you think that'll make a big deal that their story
ended.
They'll have to get, I guess, maybe equivalent actors to co-star.
So I'm sure, but I'm confident they can get something done. It's going to be a smaller budget, as we said, so the CGI might be more in tune with the first Pirates movie, which there was a lot of, but not to the degree that was in At World's End, right?
Right, of course. And there have been some director rumors, is that right?
Yeah, what was it? Rob Marshall, I believe it was,
the
director of Chicago and what have you. He was rumored a couple months ago to be attached to it. He was circling it. But yeah, no official director yet. But my idea is now that a timeline's been established, a title's been named, we're going to see more and more stuff out of the floodgates in the next couple of months.
That sounds great. Well, we got some more Disney news based on that same presentation that took place. John Lasseter, the head of Disney Animation, gave some fresh new details about the plot of the upcoming Cars 2, also due in summer of 2011, including the news that a large section of the plot will focus on Larry the Cable Guy's character, Mater. The story sees Lightning McQueen, played by Owen Wilson, his pit team, and his new pit boss, Mater, head around the world for the Race of Champions to take place in five different countries and involve the champions of different disciplines like Formula One and rally driving. First up is a race in Tokyo, starting at Mount Fuji and heading down. And then there's a German race through the Black Forest, then Porto Corsa in Italy, which is based partly on the Monte Carlo Grand Prix, then a 24-hour race across Paris. So somewhat like the Le Mans then. And finally, a thrilling climax in London, approaching Buckingham Palace, where the guards appear to be Land Rovers. But all this racing is not the only focus. Mater, who, as we know from the series of cartoon shorts, Mater's Tall Tales, more on that in a little bit, is prone to exaggeration. He gets involved in a Hitchcock-style case of mistaken identity. He saves the life of a British secret agent called Finn McMissile, who looks a heck of a lot like an Aston Martin, and becomes embroiled in a huge spy thriller. Only no one believes him, and that, too, comes to a head at Buckingham Palace. Along the way, there are tow truck abroad pictures to be taken at the Oktoberfest in Germany, where a Mater wears Materhosen, and harassing the aforementioned palace guards. Cars 2 is being directed by Ratatouille producer Brad Lewis. In his Pixar directing film debut, we're told that the familiar voices will be returning, but we weren't told who will be voicing Finn McMissile. Still, if the studios aren't in talks with one of the former James Bonds, we'd be amazed.
Oh, is that a segue?
It is a bit of a segue, because Dennis has a story for us about Timothy Dalton being in Toy Story 3.
So what would you say if Timothy Dalton, instead of his normal, "I'm Bond, James Bond," said, "I'm Pants, Mr. Pricker, Mr. Prickle Pants. It kind of just doesn't have the same menace, does it?
No.
So, anyway, Timothy Dalton, of course, is entering the, joining the Toy Story 3 franchise. The former 007, Hot Fuzz star, and all-around nice guy will be lending his voice to the Disney Pixar threequel. Disney President John Lasseter has recently announced. Of course, he will voice Mr. Prickle Pants, a hedgehog toy with thespian tendencies. How he fits into the story, we're not sure. Could he be the story's villain? Can you imagine a thespian in a children's movie? Anyway, but if Dalton is allowed to keep his accent, he will be sure the first Brit to grace the Toy Story franchise, unless you count Andy Peters' cameo in Toy Story 2. Lasseter also gave us a sneak peek at a sequence from the film and the as-yet-unreleased trailer. The clip showed Andy packing for college and emptying all his toys into a black bin bag for storage in the attic. He hesitates over Woody and Buzz, of course, finally putting Woody in the box of things to take for college. You know, imagine taking your Woody to college.
Yeah. PG here.
Hello, my name is Andy, and this is my Woody.
I was going to say, this guy obviously didn't have a great high school if he still has his toys from... If he's going to college and he still has a Woody and Buzz.
Yeah, well, you always need your Woody at college. Anyway, but all the toys are panicked, especially Woody, who's worried for his friends. When Andy is distracted by his little sister and leaves the garbage bag on the landing instead of upstairs in the attic, his mother takes it out to the curb. And a frantic Woody has to save his friends from a rapidly approaching bin lorry. So, you know, he wants to save them from the garbage dump. An as-yet-unreleased trailer showed bits of the same scene but developed the story. Clearly, the toys end up being sent to a daycare center where they are horribly abused by the little kids. And after that, it's time for a breakout attempt to find a safe haven and hopefully a new owner that can save them from a cruel world. It looks every bit as good as its Titanic predecessors and should do the same kind of box office.
I'm excited about Toy Story 3. I saw the little teaser trailer that they had before up. It's going to be in 3D. I even just saw it today, actually, on my way up here, posters, because they're re-releasing Toy Story and Toy Story 2 in 3D. I just saw posters for that on my way up here. And Toy Story, the film that kind of got the 3D, that did get the 3D animation off its... up and going and, you know, was even still, you know, 14, almost 15 years later, still looks great.
Oh, you mean the type of, like, that CGI type
CGI
animation,
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they've improved greatly since then, obviously, and they still, for me, haven't topped Finding Nemo. But Toy Story 2 was the last movie I saw of the 20th century and the first movie I saw of the 21st century.
I think the 3D thing may be a good idea. I know that Up was also available in 3D. And, you know, it looks good. They were almost too subtle, I think, with the 3D and Up. And wearing those glasses, you know, the polarized shift glasses, tends to dim the screen a little bit. So, some criticisms by diehard purists of seeing movies in theaters say that they actually didn't see a lot of benefit of seeing it in 3D. They would rather have seen it in a standard theater where the screen was brighter.
It was, yeah, good enough for...
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it still
looked
fantastic.
It's not like Polar Express or A Christmas Carol where you can tell.
Yeah.
You could tell the 3D is
going to exactly.
Be key.
So, other movies emphasize the 3D more, and we'll have to see... of course, it's going to be fantastic, I think. We'll have to see if the 3D makes a bit of a difference. I doubt that it does.
I wonder how well it's going to do. Like, but you know what? It probably will do good because I'm sure the Toy Story movies are still prominent even now. We're like a generation and half after the first one.
Oh, sure. Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm sure kids would be very happy to see a Toy Story in theaters. And I believe it's coming out holidays 2010.
And I think that Tim Allen's probably available.
Tim Allen, yeah. Tim Allen, I'm sure it's
Tom Hanks.
I want to know... who they're going to get to play the Slinky Dog, because Jim Varney passed away,
right,
as we all know, and he was the voice of the Slinky
Dog. Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Or if they're even going to have Slinky Dog anymore.
I bet it's going to be André Philippe Gagnon.
All right, so we got a very cool story now about a TV show becoming a movie. We haven't heard about those before, Starsky and Hutch, Dukes of Hazzard, Charlie's Angels. But this is another one that hopefully they'll add a bit of an edge to. The A-Team, which I loved when I was a kid, and anybody between the ages of 30 and 40 who watch TV on a regular basis loved the A-Team, starring a bunch of people from all kinds of different walks of life, including George Peppard, And Dwight Schultz, who ended up becoming a regular character in Star Trek The Next Generation. And, of course, after Rocky, Mr. T as B.A. Baracus. Well, there have been some web reports that stated that rapper The Game had been cast for B.A. In this big screen adaptation of The A-Team. But it looks like, despite denying the rumors, UFC fighter Quentin Ramon Jackson has been cast and has reported to the set in Vancouver already. Now the concentration, of course, is on who will play the pilot on the team, Captain H.M. Howling Mad Murdoch, who was played by Dwight Schultz in the original TV version. Through a reliable source, blackfilm.com has learned exclusively that an offer has been made to rising star of District 9, Charlto Copley, for the role. There's no confirmation that Copley has accepted it as of yet. Many names are being tossed around for the role, like the likes of Jim Carrey, Steve Buscemi, Timothy Oliphant, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Chris Pine, and even Robert Downey Jr. If you break it down, you can scratch Carrey and Downey Jr. off the list. They're way too big to take a supporting role, along with a couple of rising stars. Plus, their paycheck would not be big for this movie, and they'd probably demand a little bit more money. If the thought process of the executive is to find someone who has less star power, take out Woody Harrelson, take out Timothy Oliphant, take out definitely Sam Rockwell. You know, those are too easy. With Copley, we don't know much outside of his one film to date, which has grossed $103
million
domestically so far. But, you know, it's not, although his role is strong and he was an exceptional actor, it's not because of him. People aren't going to see him in the movie. They're going to see the cool special effects in the story. Already cast in the A-Team movie are Liam Neeson as Colonel John Hannibal Smith, who was played by George Peppard in the original, and Bradley Cooper as Lieutenant Templeman Face Man Peck. That's, you know, great casting there so far. The A-Team, of course, revolves around the four members of a former commando unit and their and a current group of mercenaries. Their leader is, of course, Colonel John Hannibal Smith, whose plans tend to be unorthodox but effective. Lieutenant Templeman, the Face Man, usually referred to simply as Face, is a smooth-talking con man who serves as the team's appropriator of vehicles and other useful items. The team's pilot, of course, is Captain H.M. Howling Mad Murdoch, who's been declared insane and resides in a mental institution for the show's first four seasons. And they keep breaking him up for every show. It's kind of ridiculous. And finally, there's the team's strongman and mechanic, Sergeant B.A. Bad Attitude Baracus. And if you know the show, he hates flying, so every show they had to come up with a gimmick where they drugged him unconscious and threw him on the plane or helicopter, and he fell for it every single time.
I'm just thinking the Family Guy.
Yeah. The movie's set for release next year. It's being directed by Joe Carnahan, who originally was really tight with Tom Cruise until talks between him and Cruise fell apart for Mission Impossible 3. They've already begun shooting, like I said, in Vancouver, British Columbia. So I'm looking forward to that, and hopefully with Carnahan as director, it should be pretty gritty. We got a story now for...
Before you go on, yeah. I wanted to mention about Liam Neeson. There's a Toronto Film Festival hook there. Is that there was word that Liam Neeson would attend the opening of Chloe, the Adam McGoyan film that he was making when the tragic death of his wife, Natasha Richardson, occurred. And the report was is that he is not coming to the Toronto Festival, and that he never was going to attend, that he is still mourning the death, and he couldn't face the media with, you know, their inevitable questions. Anyway, just a little tidbit there for you.
Yeah, and it'll be good to see him on screen, of course. He really hasn't dropped out of doing films. He's still been making films on a regular basis. He did wrap up the film he was shooting when his wife passed away, and he continues to work. It's certainly going to be, you know, not a demanding film. It's going to be, you know, maybe physically it'll be demanding, but it's not something I don't think that they're going to have to stretch their acting chops with. It's an action movie. We got a story here about Jeff Bridges in talks for
True Grit. I've got this one here. So in what is shaping up to be a Big Lebowski reunion, Jeff Bridges is in discussions with Paramount to star in Joel and Ethan Coen's redo of True Grit. Bridges would play the role that won John Wayne an Oscar in the 1969 original film. Bridges last worked with the Coens when he turned in a heralded performance as Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski in the 1998 cult favorite, which I still haven't seen.
Oh.
The picture This picture, which also reunites the Coens with their No Country for Old Men producing partner Scott Rudin, has been redrafted by the brothers to be more faithful to the Charles Portis novel on which the original film was based. The story centers on a 14-year-old girl who tags along with an aging U.S. Marshal, Rooster Coburn, and another lawman to track the outlaw who killed her father. The original story was told from Coogan's point of view, but the new version will work from the viewpoint of the little girl. The Coens' premiere of A Serious Man is at the Toronto International Film Festival. Jeff Bridges most recently starred in The Men Who Stare at Goats and reprised his role for Tron Legacy, which was a big trailer premiere at Comic-Con in summer. Looks incredibly awesome.
That's another movie you need to see if you haven't seen it already.
I haven't seen Tron yet.
Oh,
I haven't.
So cool.
But I saw the trailer for Tron Legacy coming out in March, I believe. And yeah, it made me want to watch Tron.
Well, Children of the Corn is on the way back. Dimension Films has hired screenwriter Aaron Kruger, who wrote Reindeer Games and The Brothers Grimm, to work on a new movie based upon the Stephen King short story that inspired a 1984 horror film and led to six more sequels. Children of the Corn was the story of a married couple that discovers a strange small town in Nebraska where there are no adults and all of the children worship a sort of corn god. Calling the original movie a missed opportunity, Dimension's Bob Weinstein said, "If you read the short story, it's got such a strong feeling to it, and there's this religious overtone to it as well."
So another remake.
Mm-hmm.
Another horror remake. It's, you know, another... it's just continuing with the trend, and then there's going to be, you know, Children of the Corn again.
It's a little bit of an odd movie to be remaking. There's a bunch of direct-to-video sequels that were pretty much god-awful. I don't think anybody's going to argue about that.
Corn god-awful.
Corn god-awful, yeah. All right, we've got one final story, which I think is kind of cool. Now that the summer season has wrapped up, I imagine box office attendance kind of drops during the fall. And, you know, it's already spiked dramatically this year thanks to the recession. Cineplex Entertainment now, they're looking to continue that trend. The cinema chain's new TELUS half-price movie combo, which is being sponsored by the telecommunications giant here in Canada, includes a movie, a regular popcorn, and a regular fountain drink for half price on Tuesdays beginning next week. J.J. Hochran, the telecommunications company's director of marketing and communications, has said that TELUS is delighted to be working with Cineplex Entertainment to bring back Discounted Tuesdays, which has been a Canadian favorite. TELUS customers will also be eligible for special offers, and the cinema's chain's Scene Card members can earn and redeem points on Tuesday. So that's a bit of a big deal. There have been a few theaters that have been doing that on their own in the Cineplex chain, offering discounts on Tuesday. But I don't mind going to see movies and crowds, especially comedies. I think that it's certainly a good move.
I think what that shows is, once again, for the original reason that they had half-price Tuesdays, is that Tuesdays are a slow night for people to go out to the movies. So they want to get bums in chairs again.
Yeah.
And I think that, when we were talking about the story that Cineplex Odeon has achieved record results in its second quarter a few weeks ago, I mentioned the opinion that if you look at economies of scale, if they got even more people at a cheaper price, if they cut prices, that they would attract larger and make even more money in the long run. And it looks like they're trying this with the Tuesdays to see what will happen. The one thing also, I wanted to go back really briefly to the film festivals. Two points I wanted to make is that I spoke about the movie An Education starring Carey Mulligan as the 17-year-old Jenny. And I'm going to add my voice to the others who think that she's a really great candidate for Best Actress this year at the Oscars. She's a 22-year-old London actress playing a 16-year-old turning 17, and she is cute and charming and a real delight. And the second point is I want to give my tip of the hat to AMC Theaters at Yonge and Dundas Square. I went to see a film there the other day, and instead of having us stand in line, they took us into an empty theater and sat us down in empty chairs so that we could sit in line rather than stand in line. And then they, you know, took us in order, very orderly, and it was just great. So tip of the hat to them. It was very well organized.
That theater chain, I guess, can do that because they've got so many darn screens in every one of their theaters. The AMC, I believe, has 20 or 24 screens, so they can certainly accommodate people. We have one more piece of unfortunate and sad news regarding a legendary screenwriter. Aaron, you got a story about the passing of Larry Gelbart.
Larry Gelbart, who was the award-winning writer whose sly, sardonic wit helped create such hits as Broadway's A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, as well as the films Tootsie and Oh God, and most importantly, maybe chiefly, television's MASH, passed away Friday after a long battle with cancer in his Beverly Hills home. He was 81 years old. His wife of 53 years, Pat Gilbert, told the Associated Press Friday that after being married for so long, we were able to finish each other's sentences. She declined, however, to tell the type of cancer which he had. Gilbert, who won a Tony for A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, as well as an Emmy for MASH, and was nominated for two Oscars, is most likely best remembered for the long-running TV show about Army doctors during the Korean War. MASH debuted on CBS in 1972 when the nation was still embroiled in the Vietnam War, and some viewers were initially puzzled or offended by its depiction of the cynical, wisecracking physicians who worked frantically to save the lives of soldiers. By its second season, it had caught on, however, and it remained one of the television's top 10 rated shows for a decade until its final episode in 1983, which I believe holds the record for the most watched series finale in history. Along the way, MASH won numerous awards, including the Emmy for Best Comedy Series. So that's some sad news of a key figure on a legendary show.
Yeah, it certainly is. MASH was definitely a staple of 70s television. And, of course, its final episode was one of the most watched TV shows of all time. It's very sad to hear about his passing. All right, so that should wrap things up for this show of Inside Movies and TV, number 68. Thank you very much for listening. Check out the blog at moviesandtvcast.blogspot.com. You can find this episode and others on our official website, moviesandtvcast.podomatic.com.
IMTV.
I did get it right. IMTV.podomatic.com. And it's because of that other IMTV person who's stolen all the IMTV URLs. And, Of course, you can subscribe to us on iTunes as well. Please leave a comment or kudo. You can also email your comments, complaints, and suggestions to moviesandtvcast@gmail.com. Dennis, once again, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll look forward to hearing about your Toronto International Film Festival experience next week. And Aaron, once again, thank you for your continued vigilance and maintenance and supervisoryship of the blog. And thank you, the listeners, for checking us out once again. And we'll be back next week for more Inside Movies and TV. Let the credits roll. We're